Side 7. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 212. I hear there was some pre-war tradition. Pantivy hanging plaintive now in the doorway. But Bloat and I are members of the new generation. We have to depend on Yank expertise. Whereupon Bloat leaps from the bed and seeks to enlighten Slothrop with a song. The Englishman's very shy. Foxtrot. Bloat. The Englishman's very shy. He's none of your Casanova. At bowling the ladies over, Americans lead the pack. Pantivy. You see, your Englishman tends to lack that recklessness transatlantic that women find so romantic, though frankly I can't see why. Bloat. The polygamous Yank with his girls galore gives your British rake or carouser fits. Pantivy. Though he's secretly held in reverent awe at a sort of erotic Clausewitz. Together. If only one could ally American bedroom know-how with British good looks, then oh how those lovelies would swoon and sigh, though you and I know the Englishman's very shy. Well, you've sure come to the right place, nods Slothrop, convinced. Only don't expect me to put it in for you. Just the initial approach, Bloat says. Moi! Pantivy has meanwhile been screaming down from the balcony. Moi, Pantivy, you know, Pantivy. Pantivy, replies a dim girl chorus from outside and below. J'ai deux amis, aussi, by an odd coincidence, par une bizarre coincidence, or something, oui? Slothrop, at this point shaving, wanders out with the foamy badger brush in his fist to see what's happening, and collides with Bloat, who's dashing to peer down over his compatriot's left epaulette at three pretty girls' faces, upturned, straw-haloed each by a giant sun hat, smiles all dazzling, eyes mysterious as the sea behind them. I say ooh, inquires Bloat. Ooh, you know, déjeuner? Glad I could help you out, Slothrop mutters, lathering Pantivy between the shoulder blades. But come with us, the girls are calling above the waves, two of them holding up an enormous wicker basket out of which lean sleek green wine bottles and rough-crusted loaves still from under their white cloth steaming in little wisps feathering off of chestnut glazes and paler split streaks. Come, sur la plage. I'll just, Bloat half out the door, keep them company until you... Sur la plage. Pantivy a bit dreamy, blinking in the sun, smiling down at their good morning's wishes come true. Oh, it sounds like a painting, something by an impressionist, a fauve, full of light. Slothrop goes, flicking witch hazel off his hands. The smell in the room brings back a moment of Berkshire Saturdays, bottles of plum and amber tonics, fly-studded paper twists swayed by the overhead fan, twinges of pain from blunt scissors. Struggling out of his sweatshirt, lit cigarette in his mouth, smoke coming out the neck like a volcano. Hey, could I bum one of your... You've already got the pack, cries Pantivy. God almighty, what is that supposed to be? What's what? Slothrop's face, nothing but innocent as he slips into and begins to button the object in question. You're joking, of course. The young ladies are waiting, Slothrop. Do put on something civilized. There's a good chap. All set, Slothrop on the way past the mirror, combing his hair into the usual sporty Bing Crosby pompadour. You can't expect us to be seen with... My brother Hogan sent it to me, Slothrop lets him know. For my birthday, all the way from the Pacific. See on the back? Under the fellows in that outrigger canoe there, to the left of those hibiscus blossoms that says Souvenir of Honolulu? This is the authentic item, Mucker Maffick, not some cheap imitation. Dear God... moans Pantivy, trailing him forlornly out of the room, shading his eyes from the shirt which glows slightly in the dimness of the corridor. At least tuck it in and cover it with something. Here, I'll even lend you this Norfolk jacket. Sacrifice indeed. The coat is from a Savile Row establishment whose fitting rooms are actually decorated with portraits of all the venerable sheep, some nobly posed up on crags, others in pensive soft close-ups, from whom the original fog-silvered wool was sheared. Must be woven out of that barbed wire, is Slothrop's opinion. What girl'd want to get near anything like that? Ah, but would any woman in her right mind want to be within 10 miles of that ghastly shirt, eh? Wait. From some place, Lothrop now produces a gaudy yellow, green, and orange display handkerchief, and over Tantivy's groans of horror, arranges it in his friend's jacket pocket so as to stick out in three points. There, beaming. That's what you call real sharp. They emerge into sunlight. Gulls begin to wail. The garment on Slothrop blazes into a refulgent life of its own. Tantivy squeezes his eyes shut. When he opens them, the girls are all attached to Slothrop, stroking the shirt, nibbling at its collar points, cooing in French. Of course, Tantivy picks up the basket. Right. The girls are dancers. The manager of the casino, Hermann Göring, one César Flabotomo, brought in a whole chorus line soon as the liberators arrived, though he hasn't yet found time to change the place's occupation name. Nobody seems to mind it up there, a pleasant mosaic of tiny and perfect seashells, thousands of them set in plaster, purple, pink, and brown, replacing a huge section of roof. The old tiles still lie in a heap beside the casino. Put up 2 years ago as recreational therapy, by a Messerschmitt squadron on furlough, in German typeface, expansive enough to be seen from the air, which is what they had in mind. The sun now is still too low to touch the words into any more than some bare separation from their ground, so that they hang suppressed, no relation any more to the men, the pain in their hands, the blisters that grew black under the sun with infection and blood, only receding as the party now walk down past sheets and pillowcases of the hotel, spread to dry on the slope of the beach, fine wrinkles edged in blue that will flow away as the sun climbs. 6 pairs of feet, stirring debris never combed for, an old gambling chip half bleached by the sun, translucent bones of gulls, a drab singlet, Wehrmacht issue, torn and blotted with bearing grease. They move along the beach. Slothrop's amazing shirt, Pantivy's handkerchief, girls' frocks, green bottles all dancing, everyone talking at once, boy and girl lingua franca, the girls confiding quite a lot to each other with side glances for their escorts. This ought to be good for a bit of the early paranoia here, a sort of pick-me-up to help face what's sure to come later in the day. But it isn't. Much too good a morning for that. Little waves are rolling in, breaking pie-crust-wise along a curve of dark shingle. Farther off, foaming among the black rocks that poke up along the cap. Out at sea wink twin slivers of a boat's sails, being sucked along in the sun and distance over toward Antibes, the craft tacking gradual, cockle frail among low swells, whose touch and rowdy hiss along the chines Slothrop can feel this morning, reminded of pre-war comets and Hamptons sighted from the beach at Cape Cod. Among land odors, drying seaweed, summer-old cooking oil, the feel of sand on sunburn, the sharp-pointed dune grass under bare feet. Closer to shore, a pedalo full of soldiers and girls moves along. They dangle, splash, sprawl in green and white striped lounge chairs back aft. At the edge of the water, small kids are chasing, screaming, laughing in that hoarse, helplessly tickled little kid way. Up on the esplanade, an old couple sit on a bench, blue and white in a cream-colored parasol, a mourning habit, an anchor for the day. They go as far as the first rocks, finding there an inlet partly secluded from the rest of the beach and from the looming casino. Breakfast is wine, bread, smiling, sun diffracting through the fine gratings of long dancers' hair, swung, flipped, never still, a dazzle of violet, sorrel, saffron, emerald. For a moment you can let the world go, solid forms gone a-fracturing, warm inside of bread waiting at your fingertips. Flowery wine in long, easy passage streaming downward around the root of your tongue. Bloat cuts in. I say, Slothrop, is she a friend of yours, too? What's happening? She what? Here sits Bloat, smug, gesturing over at the rocks and a tide pool nearby. You're getting the eye, old man. Well, she must have come out of the sea. At this distance, some 20 meters, he is only a dim figure in a black bombazine frock that reaches to her knees, her bare legs long and straight, a short hood of bright blonde hair keeping her face in shadow, coming up in guiches to touch her cheeks. She's looking at Slothrop all right. He smiles, sort of waves. She only continues to stand, the breeze pushing at her sleeves. He turns back to draw the cork from a wine bottle, and its pop arrives as a grace note for a scream from one of the dancers. Tantivy's already halfway to his feet, Bloat gaping out in the girl's direction, The danseuse's snapshot and defense reflexes, hair flying, frocks twisted, thighs flashing.
Holy shit, it's moving. An octopus? Yes, it is the biggest fucking octopus Slothrop has ever seen outside of the movies, Jackson, and it has just risen up out of the water and squirmed halfway onto one of the black rocks. Now cocking a malignant eye at the girl, it reaches out, wraps one long, sucker-studded tentacle around her neck as everyone watches, another around her waist, and begins to drag her, struggling, back under the sea. Slothrop's up, bottle in hand, running down past Aunt Ivy, who's doing a hesitant dance step, hands patting lounge suit pockets for weapons that aren't there. More and more of the octopus revealed the closer he comes, and wow, it's a big one, holy cow, skids to a halt alongside, 1 foot in the tide pool, and commences belting the octopus in the head with the wine bottle. Hermit crabs slide in death struggle around his foot. The girl, already half in the water, is trying to cry out, but the tentacle, flowing and chilly, barely allows her windway enough to breathe. She reaches out a hand, a soft-knuckled child's hand with a man's steel ID bracelet on the wrist, and clutches at Slothrop's Hawaiian shirt, begins tightening her own grip there, and who was to know that among her last things would be vulgar-faced hula girls, ukuleles, and surf riders, all in comic book colors. Oh, God, God, please, the bottle thudding again and again wetly into octopus flesh. No fucking use. The octopus gazes at Slothrop triumphant, while he, in the presence of certain death, can't quit staring at her hand. Cloth furrowing in tangents to her terror, a shirt button straining at a single last thread. He sees the name on the bracelet, scratched silver letters, each one clear but making no sense to him before the slimy gray stranglehold that goes tightening, liquid, stronger than he and she together, framing the poor hand its cruel tetanus is separating from earth. Slothrop! Hears Bloat 10 feet away, offering him a large crab. What the fuck? Maybe if he broke the bottle on the rock, stabbed the bastard between the eyes. It's hungry. It'll go for the crab. Don't kill it, Slothrop. Here, for God's sake. And here it comes, spinning through the air, legs cocked centrifugally outward. Dithering, Slothrop drops the bottle just before the crab smacks against his other palm. Neat catch. Immediately, through her fingers and his shirt, he can feel the reflex to food. Okay. Shaking, Slothrop waves the crab at the octopus. Chow time, fella. Another tentacle moves in. Its corrugated ooze touches his wrist. Slothrop tosses the crab a few feet along the beach, and what do you know? That octopus goes for it, all right. Dragging along the girl and Slothrop, staggering for a bit, then letting her go. Slothrop quickly snatches up the crab again, dangling it so the octopus can see, and begins to dance the creature away down the beach, drool streaming from its beak, eyes held by the crab. In their brief time together, Slothrop forms the impression that this octopus is not in good mental health, though where's his basis for comparing? But there is a mad exuberance, as with inanimate objects which fall off of tables when we are sensitive to noise and our own clumsiness and don't want them to fall, a sort of wham. Ha ha, you hear that? Here it is again. Wham! In the cephalopod's every movement, which Slothrop is glad to get away from as he finally scales the crab like a discus. With all his strength, out to sea, and the octopus, with an eager splash and gurgle, strikes out in pursuit and is presently gone. The frail girl lies on the beach, taking in great breaths of air, surrounded now by the others. One of the dancers is holding her in her arms and speaking R's and nasals, still French, in a language Slothrop, moseying back into earshot, can't quite place. Aunt Ivy smiles and flips a small salute. Good show, cheers Teddy Bloat. I wouldn't have wanted to try that myself. Why not? You had that crab.
Say, where'd you get that crab?
Found it, replies Bloat with a straight face. Slothrop stares at this bird but can't get eye contact. What the fuck's going on? I better have some of that wine, Slothrop reckons. He drinks out of the bottle. Air goes splashing upward in lopsided spheres inside the green glass. The girl watches him. He stops for breath and smiles. Thank you, Lieutenant. Not a tremor in the voice, and the accent is Teutonic. He can see her face now. Soft nose of a doe. Eyes behind blonde lashes full of acid green. One of those thin-lipped European mouths. I had almost stopped breathing. You're not German. Shaking her head, no, emphatically. Dutch. And have you been here? Her eyes go elsewhere. She reaches, takes the bottle from his hand. She is looking out to sea after the octopus. They are very optical, aren't they? I hadn't known. It saw me. Me. I don't look like a crab.
I guess not. You're a swell-looking lady.
In the background, delighted bloat nudges Tantivy, that recklessness transatlantic. Slothrop takes her wrist, finds no problem now reading that ID bracelet says Katya Borgesius. He can feel her pulse booming. Does she know him from someplace? Strange. A mixture of recognition and sudden shrewdness in her face. So it is here, grouped on the beach with strangers, that voices begin to take on a touch of metal, each word a hard-edged clap, and the light, though as bright as before, is less able to illuminate. It's a Puritan reflex of seeking other orders behind the visible, also known as paranoia, filtering in. Pale lines of force whir in the sea air, pacts sworn to in rooms since shelled back to their planned views, not quite by accident of war, suggest themselves. Oh, that was no found crab, Ace. No random octopus or girl. Structure and detail come later, but the conniving around him now he feels instantly in his heart. They all stay a bit longer on the beach, finishing breakfast. But the simple day, birds and sunlight, girls and wine, has sneaked away from Slothrop. Tantivy is getting drunk, more relaxed and funnier as the bottle's empty. He staked out not only the girl he first had his eye on, but also the one Slothrop would be no doubt sweet-talking right now if that octopus hadn't shown up. He is a messenger from Slothrop's innocent pre-octopus past. Bloat, on the other hand, sits perfectly sober, mustache unruffled, regulation uniform, watching Slothrop closely. His companion, Ghislaine, tiny and slender, pin-up girl legs, long hair brushed behind her ears, falling all the way down her back, shifts her round bottom in the sand, writing marginal commentaries around the text of Bloat. Slothrop, who believes that women, like Martians, have antennas men do not, keeps an eye on her. She looks over only once, and her eyes grow wide and cryptic. He'd swear she knows something. On the way back to the casino, toting their empties and the basket full of the debris of the morning, he manages a word with her. Some picnic, n'est-ce pas? Dimples appear next to her mouth. Did you know all the time about the octopus? I thought so, because it was so like a dance, all of you.
No, honestly, I didn't. You mean you thought it was just a practical joke or something?
Little Tyrone, she whispers, suddenly taking his arm with a big phony smile for the others. Little? He's twice her size. Please be very careful. That's all. He has Katya by the other hand, two imps contrary either side. The beach is empty now except for 50 gray gulls sitting watching the water. White heaps of cumulus pose out at sea, hard-surfaced, cherub-blown, palm leaves stir all down the esplanade. Ghislaine drops away, back down the beach to pick up Prim Bloat. Katya squeezes Slothrop's arm and tells him just what he wants to hear about now. Perhaps, after all, we were meant to meet. From out at sea, the casino at this hour is a blazing bijou at the horizon. Its foil of palms already shadows in the dwindling light. Deepening go the yellow-brown of these small serrated mountains, sea-colored the soft inside of a black olive, white villas, perched chateau, whole and ruined, autumn greens of copses and solitary pines, all deepening to the nightscape latent across them all day. Fires are lit on the beach. A faint babble of English voices, and even occasional songs, reaches across the water to where Dr. Porkyovich stands on deck. Below, Octopus Grigori, having stuffed himself with crab meat, frisks happily in his special enclosure. The reaching radius of the lighthouse on the headland sweeps by as tiny fishing craft head out to sea. Grisha, little friend, you have performed your last trick for a while. Is there any hope for further support from pointsmen now that Porkyovich and his fabulous octopus have done their part? He gave up questioning orders long ago, even questioning his exile. The evidence linking him to the Bukharin conspiracy, whose particulars he has never heard, might somehow be true. The Trotskyite bloc might have known of him by reputation, used him in ways forever secret. forever secret. There are forms of innocence, he knows, that cannot conceive of what that means, much less accept it as he has. For it might, after all, be only another episode in some huge pathological dream of Stalin's. At least he had physiology, something outside the party. Those who had nothing but the party, who had built their whole lives upon it only to be purged, must go through something very like death. And never to know anything for certain, never to have the precision of the laboratory. It's been his own sanity, God knows, for 20 years. At least they can never... No. No, they wouldn't. There's never been a case. Unless it's been hushed up. You'd never read it in the journals, of course. Would Pointsman? He might. Yes. Grisha, Grisha. It's come true. On us, so quickly. Foreign cities, comedians in broken hats, can-can girls, fountains of fire, a noisy pit band. Grisha, with the flags of all the nations curled in your arms, fresh shellfish, a warm pirozhok, hot glasses of tea in the evenings between performances, learn to forget Russia, to take comfort from what mean, falsified bits of her we wander across. Now the sky stretches to admit a single first star, but Porkievich makes no wish. Policy. Signs of arrival do not interest him, nor even signs of departure. As the boat's engine goes full ahead, their own wake goes lifting, pink with sunset, to obscure the white casino on shore. Electricity is on tonight, the casino back in France's power grid. Chandeliers shaggy with crystal needles flare overhead, and softer lamps shine among the gardens outside. Going into dinner with Pantivy and the dancers, Slothrop is brought to a round-eyed halt by the sight of Katya Borgesius, hair in one of those emerald tiaras, the rest of her rigged out in a long Medici gown of sea-green velvet. Her escort's a 2-star general and a brigadier. R-H-I-P, sings Tantivy, shuffling off sarcastic buffaloes along the carpet. Oh, R-H-I-P, indeed. You're trying to get my goat, Slothrop smiles, but it's not working. I can tell. His own smile freezes. Oh, no, Slothrop, please, no, we're going into dinner. Well, I know we're going into dinner. No, this is very embarrassing. You've got to take it off. You like that? She's genuine hand-painted. Look, nice tits, huh? It's the Wormwood Scrub School tie. In the main dining room, they merge into a great coming and going of waiters, officers, and ladies. Slothrop, young dancer by the hand, caught up in the eddying, manages at last to slide with her into a pair of seats just vacated, to find who but Katya, his left-hand partner. He puffs out his cheeks, crosses his eyes, brushes his hair industriously with his hands, by which time the soup has showed up, which he goes at as if disarming a bomb. Katya is ignoring him, talking earnestly instead across her general with some bird colonel about his pre-war profession, managing a golf course in Cornwall. Holes and hazards. Gave one a feel for terrain. But he did like most to be there at night when the badgers came out of their sets to play. By the time the fish has come and gone, something funny is happening. Katya's knee seems to be rubbing Slothrop's, velvet warm under the table. Well, opines Slothrop, watch this. I will employ some of that subterfuge. I mean, I'm in that Europe, aren't I? He raises his wine glass and announces... The Ballad of Tantivy Mucker Mafic. Cheers go up. Bashful Tantivy tries not to smile. It's a song everyone knows. One of the Scotsmen goes dashing down the room to the grand piano. Cesar Flebotimo, twirling his slick mustache in a saber point, nips behind a palm in a tub to turn the lights up a notch, sticks his head back out winking and hisses for his maître d'hôtel. Wine is gargled, throats are cleared, and a good number of the company commence singing. The Ballad of Tantivy Mucker Mafic. Oh, Italian gin is a mother's curse, and the beer of France is septic. Drinking bourbon in Spain is the lonely domain of the saint and the epileptic. White lightning has fueled up many a hearse in the mountains where ridge runners dwell. It's a brew begot in a poisoned pot and mulled with the hammers of hell. Refrain. Oh, Tantivy's been drunk in many a place from here to the uttermost isle. And if he should refuse any chance at the booze, may I die with an hoary-eyed smile. There are what sound like 100, but most likely only 2, Welshmen singing, tenor from the south and bass from the north of the country, you see, so that all conversation, sub rosa or not, is effectively drowned out. Exactly what Slothrop wants. He leans in Katya's direction.
Meet me in my room, she whispers. 3:06 after midnight.
Gotcha. And Slothrop is upright in time to join in again right on bar 1. He's been ossified in oceans of grog, in the haunts of the wobbly whale. He's been half seas over from Durban to Dover with 4 shaky sheets to the gale. For in London fog or Sahara's sun or the ice-bound steeps of Zermatt, loaded up for a lark to his plimsoll mark, he's been game to go off on a bat. Yes, Tantive, he's been drunk in many a place, etc. After dinner, Slothrop gives Tantive the high sign. The dancers go off arm in arm to the marble lounges where the toilet stalls are equipped with a network of brass voice tubes, all acoustic, to make stall-to-stall conversation easier. Slothrop and Tantive head for the nearest bar. Listen, Slothrop talking into his highball glass, bouncing words off of ice cubes so they'll have a proper chill. Either I'm coming down with a little psychosis here, or something funny is going on, right? Tantive, who is feigning a relaxed air, breaks off humming, "You can do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town," to inquire, "Ah, yes, do you really think so? Come on, that octopus." "The devilfish is found quite commonly on Mediterranean shores, though usually not so large. Is it the size that bothers you? Don't Americans like..." "Tantive, it was no accident. Did you hear that bloat? Don't kill it. He had a crab with him. Maybe inside that musette bag, all set to lure that critter away with. And where'd he go tonight, anyhow?" "I think he's out on the beach. There's a lot of drinking."
"He drinks a lot?"
"No."
"Look, you're his friend," Tantive moans.
"God, Slothrop, I don't know. I'm your friend, too, but there's always, you know, an element of Slothropian paranoia to contend with."
"Paranoia's ass. Something's up. And you know it."
Tantive chews ice, sights along a glass stirring rod, rips up a small napkin into a snowstorm, all sorts of bar business, he's an old hand, but at last in a soft voice, "Well, he's receiving messages in code."
"Ha!
I saw one in his kit this afternoon, just a glimpse. I didn't try to look closer. He is with Supreme Headquarters, after all. I suppose that could be it."
"No, that's not it. Now, what about this?" And Slothrop tells about his midnight bait with Katya.
For a moment, they might almost be back in the bureau at Achtung, and the rockets falling, and tea and paper cups and everything right again.
"Are you going?"
"Shouldn't I? You think she's dangerous?"
"I think she's delightful.
If I hadn't Françoise, not to mention Yvonne, to worry about, I'd be racing you to her door."
"But..."
But the clock over the bar only clicks once. Then, presently again, ratcheting time minute-wise into their past.
"Either what you've got is contagious," Tantive begins, "or else they've an eye on me, too."
They look at each other. Slothrop remembers that except for Tantive, he's all alone here. "Tell me."
"I wish I could. He's changed, but I couldn't give you a single bit of evidence. It's been since, I don't know, autumn. He doesn't talk politics anymore. God, we used to get into these... He won't discuss his plans after he's demobed, either. It's something he used to do all the time. I thought the Blitz might have got him rattled, but after yesterday, I think it must be more. Damn it, it makes me sad."
"What happened?"
"Oh, a sort of... not a threat, or not a serious one. I mentioned, only joking, that I was keen on your Katya. And Bloat became very cold and said, I'd stay clear of that one if I were you. Tried to cover it with a laugh, as if he had his eye on her, too, but that wasn't it. I don't have his confidence anymore. I feel I'm only useful to him in a way I can't see. Being tolerated for as long as he can use me. The old university connection, I don't know if you ever felt it at Harvard. From time to time back in Oxford, I came to sense a peculiar structure that no one admitted to, that extended far beyond Pearl Street, past Corn Market, into covenants procuring accounts due. One never knew who it would be, or when, or how they'd try to collect it, but I thought it only idle, only at the fringes of what I was really up there for, you know?"
"Sure. In that America, it's the first thing they tell you. Harvard's there for other reasons. The educating part of it is just sort of a front."
"We're so very innocent here, you see. Some of you, maybe. I'm sorry about bloat. I still hope it's something else.
I guess so, but what do we do right now?
Oh, I'd say keep your date. Be careful. Keep me posted. Perhaps tomorrow I'll have an adventure or two to tell you about for a change, and if you need help, teeth flashing, face reddening a bit, well, I'll help you.
Thanks, Tent Ivy. Jesus, a British ally. Yvonne and Francoise peek in, beckoning them outside, onto the Himmler Spielsaal and Chemin de Fer till midnight. Swarthrop breaks even, Tent Ivy loses, and the girls win. No sign of bloat, though dozens of officers go drifting in and out, brown and distant as rotogravure, through the evening. Nor any sight of this girl, Giselaine. Swarthrop asks. Yvonne shrugs.
Out with your friend? Who knows?
Giselaine's long hair and tanned arms, her six-year-old face in a smile. If it turns out she does know something, is she safe? At 11:59, Swarthrop turns to Tant Ivy, nods at the two girls, tries to chuckle lewdly, and gives his friend a quick, affectionate punch in the shoulder. Once, back in prep school, just before sending him into a game, young Slothrop's football coach socked him the same way, giving him confidence for at least 50 seconds, till being trampled flat on his ass by a number of red-dogging chote boys, each with the instincts and mass of a killer rhino. "Good luck," says Tant Ivy, meaning it, hand already reaching for Yvonne's sweet chiffon bottom. Minutes of doubt, yes, yes. Slothrop ascending flights of red-carpeted stairway. "Welcome, Mr. Slothrop. Welcome to our structure. We hope you will enjoy your visit here." Malachite nymphs and satyrs paralyzed in chase, evergreen at the silent landings upward toward a single staring bulb at the top. At her door, he pauses long enough to comb his hair. Now she wears a white pelisse with sequins all over, padded shoulders, jagged white ostrich plumes at the neckline and wrists. The tiara is gone. In the electricity, her hair is new snowfall. But inside, a single scented candle burns, and the suite is washed in moonlight. He pours brandy in old flint snifters, and as he reaches, their fingers touch.
"Didn't know you were so daffy about that golf."
Suave, romantic Slothrop.
"He was pleasant. I was being pleasant to him."
One eye kind of squinched up, forehead wrinkled. Slothrop wonders if his fly's open.
"And ignore me. Why?"
"Clever pounce there, Slothrop." But she only evaporates before the question, reforms in another part of the room.
"Am I ignoring you?"
She's at her window, the sea below and behind her, the midnight sea, its individual wave flows impossible at this distance to follow, all integrated into the hung stillness of an old painting seen across the deserted gallery where you wait in the shadow, forgetting why you are here, frightened by the level of illumination, which is from the same blanched scar of moon that wipes the sea tonight.
"I don't know, but you're fooling around a lot."
"Perhaps I'm supposed to be." "As perhaps we were meant to meet?"
"Oh, you think I'm more than I am,"
gliding to a couch, tucking one leg under. "I know, you're only a Dutch milkmaid or something, closet full of those starched aprons, eh, and wooden shoes, right?"
"Go and look."
Spice odors from the candle reach like nerves through the room.
"Okay, I will."
He opens her closet, and in moonlight reflected from the mirror finds a crowded maze of satins, taffetas, lawn and pongee, dark fur collars and trimming, buttons, sashes, passementry, soft, confusing, womanly tunnel systems that must stretch back for miles. He could be lost inside of half a minute. Lace glimmers, eyelets wink, a crepe scarf brushes his face. Aha, wait a minute. The operational scent in here is carbon tet, Jackson, and this wardrobe here is mostly props.
Well, pretty snazzy.
If that's a compliment, thank you.
Let them thank me, babe, and Americanism.
You're the first American I've met.
You must have got out by way of that Arnhem then, right?
My, you're quick. Her tone warning him not to go after it. He sighs, wringing the snifter with his fingernail. In the dark room, with a paralyzed and silent sea at his back, he tries singing. Too soon to know. Foxtrot. It's still too soon. It's not as if we'd kissed and kindled or chased the moon. through midnight's hush as dancing dwindled into quiet dawns over secret lawns. Too soon to know if all that breathless conversation a sigh ago was more than casual flirtation doomed to drift away into misty gray. How can we tell? What can we see? Love works its spells in hiding, quite past our own deciding. So who's to say if joyful love is just beginning, or if its day just turned to night as earth went spinning? Darling, maybe so. It's too soon to know. Knowing what is expected of her, she waits with a vapid look till he's done. Mellow, close harmony reeds humming a moment in the air, then reaches out a hand, melting toward him as he topples in slow motion toward her mouth. Feathers sliding, sleeves furling, ascending bare arms, finely moon-grained, slipping around and up his back, her tacky tongue nervous as a moth, his hands rasping over sequins. Then her breasts flatten against him as her forearms and hands go away, folding up behind her to find a zipper, bringing it snarling down her spine line. Katya's skin is whiter than the white garment she rises from. Born again. Out the window he can almost see the spot where the devilfish crawled in from the rocks. She walks like a ballerina on her toes, thighs long and curving. Slothrop undoing belt buttons, shoelaces, hopping one foot at a time. Oh boy, but the moonlight only whitens her back, and there is still a dark side, her ventral side, her face that he can no longer see. A terrible beast-like change coming over muzzle and lower jaw, black pupils growing to cover the entire eye space till whites are gone and there's only the red animal reflection. When the light comes to strike, no telling when the light... She has sunk to the deep bed, pulling him along into down, satin, seraphic, and floral embroidery, turning immediately to take his erection into her stretched fork, into a single vibration on which the night is tuning. As they fuck, she quakes, body strobing miles beneath him, in cream and night blue, all sound suppressed, eyes in crescents behind the gold lashes, jet earrings, long octahedral, flying without a sound, beating against her cheeks, black sleet, his face above her, unmoved, full of careful technique. Is it for her? Or wired into the Slothropian run together they briefed her on? She will move him. She will not be mounted by a plastic shell. Her breathing has grown more hoarse over a threshold into sound. Thinking she might be close to coming, he reaches a hand into her hair, tries to still her head, needing to see her face. This is suddenly a struggle, vicious and real. She will not surrender her face, and out of nowhere she does begin to come, and so does Slothrop. For some reason now, she who never laughs has become the top surface of a deep rising balloon of laughter. Later, as she's about to go to sleep, she will also whisper, laughing, laughing again. He will want to say, oh, they let you, but then again maybe they don't. But the Katya he's talking to is already gone, and presently his own eyes have closed. Like a rocket whose valves under remote control open and close at prearranged moments, Slothrop, at a certain level of his re-entry into sleep, stops breathing through his nose and commences breathing through his mouth. This soon grows to snores that have been known to rattle storm windows, set shutters to swinging and chandeliers into violent tintinnabulation. Yes, indeed, at the first of these, tonight, Katya wakes up, belts him in the head with a pillow. None of that. I'm a light sleeper. Every time you snore, you get hit with this, waving the pillow. No kidding, either. The routine of snore, get belted with pillow, wake up, say, fall back to sleep, goes on well into the morning. Come on, finally, cut it out. Mouth breather, she yells. He grabs his own pillow and swings it at her. She ducks, rolls, hits the deck, fainting with her pillow, backing toward the sideboard where the booze is. He doesn't see what she has in mind till she throws her pillow and picks up the seltzer bottle. The what? The seltzer bottle? What shit is this now? What other interesting props have they thought to plant? And what other American reflexes are they after? Where's those banana cream pies, eh? He dangles two pillows and watches her. One more step, she giggles. Slothrop dives in, goes to hit her across the ass, whereupon she lets him have it with the seltzer bottle natch.
The pillow bursts against one marble hip. Moonlight in the room is choked with feathers and down, and soon with hanging spray from jets of seltzer. Strothrop keeps trying to grab the bottle. Slippery girl squirms away, gets behind a chair. Strothrop takes the brandy decanter off of the sideboard, unstoppers it, and flings a clear amber pseudopodded glob across the room twice in and out of moonlight to splash around her neck, between her black-tipped breasts, down her flanks. Bastard! Hitting him with the seltzer again. Settling feathers cling to their skins as they chase around the bedroom, her dappled body always retreating, often in this light, even at close range, impossible to see. Slothrop keeps falling over the furniture. Boy, when I get my hands on you! At which point she opens the door to the sitting room, skips through, slams it again, so Slothrop runs right into it, bounces off, says shit, opens the door to find her waving a big red damask tablecloth at him. "What's this?" inquires Slothrop. "Magic!" she cries, and tosses the tablecloth over him, precisely wrinkling folds propagating swift as crystal faults readily through the air. "Watch closely while I make one American lieutenant disappear." "Quit fooling!" Slothrop, flailing around trying to reach the outside again. "How can I watch closely when I'm in here?" He can't find an edge anyplace and feels a little panicky. "That's the idea!" Suddenly inside, next to him, lips at his nipples, hands fluttering among the hairs at the back of his neck, pulling him slowly to deep carpeting. "My little chickadee?" "Where'd you see that one, hey? Remember when he gets in bed with that goat?"
"Oh, don't ask."
This time it is a good-natured, coordinated quickie, both kind of drowsy, covered with sticky feathers. After coming, they lie close together, too liquefied to move. Damask and pile. It's so cozy and just as red as a womb in here. Curled, holding her feet in his, cock nestled in the warm cusp between her buttocks, Slothrop trying earnestly to breathe through his nose, they drop off to sleep. Slothrop wakes to morning sunlight off of that Mediterranean, filtered through a palm outside the window, then red through the tablecloth, birds, water running upstairs. For a minute he lies, coming awake, no hangover, still belonging Slothropless to some teeming cycle of departure and return. Katya lies, quick and warm, est against the S of himself, beginning to stir. From the next room he hears the unmistakable sound of an army belt buckle. "Somebody," he observes, catching on quickly, "must be robbing my pants." Feet patter by on the carpet close to his head. Slothrop can hear his own small change jingling in his pockets. "Thief!" he yells, which wakes up Katya, turning to put her arms around him. Slothrop, managing now to locate the hem he couldn't find last night, scoots from under the tablecloth just in time to see a large foot in a two-toned shoe, coffee and indigo, vanish out the door. He runs into the bedroom, finds everything else he had on is gone too, down to shoes and skivvies. "My clothes!" Running back out past Katya, now emerging from the damask and making a grab for his feet, Slothrop flings open the door, runs out in the hall, recollects that he is naked here, spots a laundry cart and grabs a purple satin bedsheet off of it, drapes it around him in a sort of toga. From the stairway comes a snicker and the pad-pad of crepe soles. "Aha!" cries Slothrop, charging down the hall. The slippery sheet will not stay on. It flaps, slides off, gets underfoot. Up the stairs, two at a time, only to find at the top another corridor just as empty. Where is everybody? From way down the hall, a tiny head appears around a corner. A tiny hand comes out and gives Slothrop the tiny finger. Unpleasant laughter reaches him a split second later, by which time he's sprinting toward it. At the stairs, he hears footsteps heading down. The great purple kite races, cursing down three flights, out a door and onto a little terrace, just in time to see somebody hop over a stone balustrade and vanish into the upper half of a thick tree, growing up from somewhere below. "Treed at last!" cries Slothrop. First you have to get into the tree, then you can climb it easy as a ladder. Once inside, surrounded by pungent leaf light, Slothrop can't see farther than a couple of limbs. The tree is shaking, though, so he reckons that that thief is in here someplace. Industriously, he climbs on, sheet catching and tearing, skin stuck by needles, scraped by bark. His feet hurt. He's soon out of breath. Gradually, the cone of green light narrows, grows brighter. Close to the top, Slothrop notes a saw cut or something partway through the trunk, but doesn't stop to ponder what it might mean till he's reached the very top of the tree and clings, swaying, enjoying the fine view of the harbor and headland, paint-blue sea, white caps, storm gathering off at the horizon, the tops of people's heads moving around far below. Gee, down the trunk he hears the sound of wood beginning to crack and feels vibration here in his slender perch. Aw, hey, that sneak. He climbed down the tree, not up. He's down there now, watching. They knew Slothrop would choose up, not down. They were counting on that damned American reflex, all right. Bad guy in a chase always heads up. Why up? And they sawed the trunk nearly through, eh? And now... They? Well, opined Slothrop, I had better, About then, the point of the tree cracks through, and with a great rustle and whoosh, a whirl of dark branches and needles breaking him up into a few thousand sharp falling pieces, down topples Slothrop, bouncing from limb to limb, trying to hold the purple sheet over his head for a parachute. Oof! About halfway to the ground, terrace level or so, he happens to look down and there observes many senior officers in uniform and plump ladies in white batiste frocks and flowered hats. They are playing croquet. It appears Slothrop will land somewhere in their midst. He closes his eyes and tries to imagine a tropical island, a secure room, where this cannot be happening. He opens them about the time he hits the ground. In the silence, before he can even register pain, comes the loud thunk of wood hitting wood. A bright yellow-striped ball comes rolling past an inch from Slothrop's nose and on, out of sight, followed a second later by a burst of congratulations, ladies enthusiastic, footfalls heading his way. Seems he's wrenched his back a little, but doesn't much feel like moving anyhow. Presently the sky is obscured by faces of some general and Teddy Bloat gazing curiously down. It's Slothrop, says Bloat, and he's wearing a purple sheet. What's this, my lad? Inquires the general. Costume theatricals, eh? He is joined by a pair of ladies beaming at or perhaps through Slothrop. Whom are you talking to, General? That blighter in the toga, replies the general, who is lying between me and my next wicket. Why, how extraordinary, Rowena, turning to her companion. Do you see a blighter in a toga? Goodness no, Joel, replies blithe Rowena. I believe the general has been drinking. The ladies begin to giggle. If the general made all his decisions in this state, Joel grasping for breath, why, there'd be sauerkraut in the Strand. The two of them shriek very loudly for an unpleasant length of time. And your name would be Brunhilde, the two faces, now a strangled rose, instead of Jewel. They are clutching each other for dear life. Slothrop glares up at this spectacle, augmented now by a cast of dozens. Well, you see, somebody swiped all my clothes, and I was just on my way to complain to the management, but decided to put on a purple bedsheet and climb a tree instead, nods the general. Well, I dare say we can fix you up with something. Bloat, you're nearly this man's size, aren't you? Oh. Croquet mallet over his shoulder, posed like an advertising display for Kilgore or Curtis, smirking down at Slothrop. I have a spare uniform somewhere. Come along, Slothrop. You're all right, aren't you? Didn't break anything? Yarr! Wrapped in his tattered sheet, helped to his feet by solicitous croqueters, Slothrop goes limping after Bloat, off the turf and into the casino. They stop first at Slothrop's room. He finds it newly cleaned, perfectly empty, ready for new guests. Hey! Yanking out drawers empty as drums, every stitch of clothing he owns is gone, including his Hawaiian shirt. What the fuck? Groaning, he rummages in the desk, empty. Closets, empty. Leave papers, ID, everything, taken. His back muscles throb with pain. What is this, Ace? Going to check out the number on the door again, everything now for form's sake. He knows Hogan's shirt bothers him most of all. First put on something respectable, Bloat's tone full of headmasterish revulsion. Two subalterns come crashing in, carrying their valises. They halt, goggling at Slothrop. Here, mate, you're in the wrong theater of operations, cries one. Show a bit of respect, the other haw-haws. It's Lawrence of Arabia. Shit, says Slothrop. Can't even lift his arm, much less swing it.
They proceed to Bloat's room, where they put together a uniform.
Say, it occurs to Slothrop, where's that mucker Maffick this morning?
I've no idea, really. Off with his girl or girls, where have you been?
But Slothrop's looking around, tightening rectal fear belatedly taking hold now, neck and face beading in a surge of sweat, trying to find in this room Tantivy shares with Bloat some trace of his friend. Bristling Norfolk jacket, pinstripe suit, anything.
Nothing.
Did that Tantivy move out or what?
He may have moved in with Francoise or what's-her-name. Even gone back to London early. I don't keep a file on him. I'm not the Missing Persons Bureau.
You're his friend?
Bloat, with an insolent shrug, for the very first time since they met, now looks Slothrop in the eyes.
Aren't you? What are you?
The answer's in Bloat's stare. The dim room become rationalized. Nothing to it of holiday, only Savile Row uniforms. Silver hairbrushes and razor arranged at right angles. A shiny spike on an octagonal base impaling half an inch of pastel flimsies, all edges neatly squared. A piece of Whitehall on the Riviera. Slothrop drops his eyes away. See if I can find him, he mumbles, retreating out the door, uniform ballooning at the ass and too tight at the waist.
Live with the way it feels, mate. You'll be in it for a while.
He begins at the bar they talked in last night. It is empty except for a colonel with a great twisted mustache with his hat on, sitting stiffly in front of something large, fizzing, opaque, and garnished with a white chrysanthemum.
Didn't they teach you at Sandhurst to salute?
This officer screams. Slothrop, hesitating only a moment, salutes.
Damned OCTU must be full of Nazis.
No bartender in sight. Can't remember what...
Well?
Actually, what I am is an American. I only borrowed the uniform and, well, I was looking for a lieutenant, or actually Lieutenant Mucker Maffick.
You're a what?
Roars the colonel, pulling leaves from the chrysanthemum with his teeth.
What kind of Nazi foolishness is that, eh?
Well, thank you. Slothrop backing out of the room, saluting again.
This is incredible!
The echo following him down the corridors to the Himmler Spielsaal.
It's Nazi!
Deserted in noon's lull, here are resonant reaches of mahogany, green baize, hanging loops of maroon velvet. Long-handled wood money rakes lie fanned out on the tables. Little silver bells with ebony handles are turned mouth down on the russet veneer. Around the tables, empire chairs are lined up precise and playerless. But some are taller than the rest. These are no longer quite outward and visible signs of a game of chance. There is another enterprise here, more real than that, less merciful, and systematically hidden from the likes of Slothrop. Who sits in the taller chairs? Do they have names? What lies on their smooth baize surfaces? Brass-colored light seeps in from overhead. Murals line the great room. Pneumatic gods and goddesses, pastel swains and shepherdesses, misty foliage, fluttering scarves, everywhere curlicued gilt festoonery drips from moldings, chandeliers, pillars, window frame. Scarred parquetry gleams under the skylight. From the ceiling to within a few feet of the tabletops hang long chains with hooks at the ends. What hangs from these hooks? For a minute here, Slothrop, in his English uniform, is alone with the paraphernalia of an order whose presence among the ordinary debris of waking he has only lately begun to suspect. There may for a moment have been some golden, vaguely root-like or man-like figure beginning to form among the brown and bright cream shadows and light here, but Slothrop isn't to be let off so easy. Shortly, unpleasantly so, it will come to him that everything in this room is really being used for something different, meaning things to them it has never meant to us. Never. Two orders of being, looking identical, but... Oh, the world over there, it's so hard to explain. Just like a dream's got lost in your brain, dancing like a fool through that forbidden wing, waiting for the light to start shivering. Well, whoever said you couldn't move that way, whoever said you couldn't try, if you find there's a little pain, you can always go back again, 'cause you don't ever really say goodbye. Why here? Why should the rainbow edges of what is almost on him be rippling most intense here in this amply coded room?
Say, why should walking in here be almost the same as entering the forbidden itself? Here are the same long rooms, rooms of old paralysis and evil distillery, of condensations and residues you are afraid to smell from forgotten corruptions, rooms full of upright gray-feathered status with wings spread, indistinct faces and dust, rooms full of dust that will cloud the shapes of inhabitants around the corners or deeper inside, that will settle on their black formal lapels, that will soften to sugar the white faces, white shirt fronts, gems and gowns, white hands that move too quickly to be seen. What game do they deal? What passes are these, so blurred, so old and perfect? Fuck you, whispers Slothrop. It's the only spell he knows, and a pretty good all-purpose one at that. His whisper is baffled by the thousands of tiny rococo surfaces. Maybe he'll sneak in tonight. No, not at night. But sometime with a bucket and brush, paint fuck you in a balloon coming out the mouth of one of those little pink shepherdesses there. He steps back out, backward out the door, as if half, his ventral half, were being struck in kingly radiance, retreating from yet facing the presence feared and wanted. Outside, he heads down toward the quay, among fun-seekers, swooping white birds, an incessant splat of seagull shit. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, saluting everybody in uniform, getting it to a reflex, don't ask for extra trouble, try for invisible, bringing his arm each time a bit more stupidly to his side. Clouds now are coming up fast out of the sea. No sign of tent ivy out here either. Ghosts of fishermen, glass workers, fur traders, renegade preachers, hilltop patriarchs, and valley politicians go avalanching back from Slothrop here, back to 1630, when Governor Winthrop came over to America on the Arbella, flagship of a great Puritan flotilla that year, on which the first American Slothrop had been a mess cook or something. There go that Arbella and its whole fleet sailing backward in formation, the wind sucking them east again, the creatures leaning from the margins of the unknown, sucking in their cheeks, growing cross-eyed with the effort, into black deep hollows at the mercy of teeth no longer the milky molars of cherubs, as the old ships zoom out of Boston Harbor, back across an Atlantic whose currents and swells go flowing and heaving in reverse, a redemption of every mess cook who ever slipped and fell when the deck made an unexpected move, the night's stew collecting itself up out of the planks and off the indignant shoes of the more elect, slithering in a fountain back into the pewter kettle as the servant himself staggers upright again and the vomit he slipped on goes bushing back into the mouth that spilled it. Presto change-o! Tyrone Slothrop's English again! But it doesn't seem to be redemption exactly that this they have in mind. He's on a broad cobbled esplanade lined with palms shifting now to coarse-grained black as clouds begin to come over the sun. Pentivy isn't out on the beach either, nor are any of the girls. Slothrop sits on a low wall, feet swinging, watching the front, slate, muddy purple, advancing from the sea in sheets and drifts. Around him the air is cooling. He shivers. What are they doing? He gets back to the casino just as big globular raindrops, thick as honey, begin to splat into giant asterisks on the pavement, inviting him to look down at the bottom of the text of the day, where footnotes will explain all. He isn't about to look. Nobody ever said a day has to be juggled into any kind of sense at day's end. He just runs. Rain grows in wet crescendo. His footfalls send up fine flowers of water, each hanging a second behind his flight. It is flight. He comes in speckled, pied with rain, begins a frantic search through the great inert casino, starting again with the same smoky, hooch-fumed bar, proceeding through the little theater where tonight will play an abbreviated version of L'Inutile Precauzione, that imaginary opera with which Rosina seeks to delude her guardian in the Barber of Seville, into its green room where girls, a silkenness of girls, but not the three Slothrop wants most to see, tease hair, arrange garters, glue on eyelashes, smile at Slothrop. No one has seen Ghislaine Françoise Yvonne. From another room the orchestra rehearses a lively Rossini tarantella. The reeds are all something like a half-tone flat. At once, Slothrop understands that he is surrounded by women who have lived a good fraction of their lives at war and under occupation.
and for whom people have been dropping out of sight every day. Yes, in one or two pairs of eyes he finds an old and European pity, a look he will get to know well before he loses his innocence and becomes one of them. So he drifts through the bright and milling gaming rooms, the dining hall and its smaller private satellites, busting up tete-a-tetes, colliding with waiters, finding only strangers wherever he looks. And if you need help, well, I'll help you. Voices, music, and shuffling of cards all grow louder, more oppressive, till he stands looking into the Himmler Spielsaal again, crowded now, jewels flashing, leather gleaming, roulette spokes whirling, blurring. It's here that saturation hits him. It's all this playing games, too much of it, too many games. The nasal, obsessive voice of a croupier he can't see, Messieurs, Madame, les jeux sont faits, is suddenly speaking out of the forbidden wing directly to him and about what Slothrop has been playing against the invisible house, perhaps after all for his soul, all day. Terrified, he turns out into the rain again where the electric lights of the casino in full holocaust are glaring off the glazed cobbles. Collar up, bloats hat down over his ears, saying shit every few minutes, shivering, his back aching from that fall out of that tree, he goes stumbling along in the rain. He thinks he might begin to cry. How did this all turn against him so fast? His friends, old and new, every last bit of paper and clothing connecting him to what he's been, have just fucking vanished. How can he meet this with any kind of grace? Only much later, worn out, snuffling, cold and wretched in his prison of soggy army wool, does he think of Katya. He gets back to the casino near midnight, her hour, tramping upstairs, leaving wet footprints behind, loud as a washing machine, stops at her door, rain pattering onto the carpet, afraid even to knock. Has she been taken too? Who's waiting behind the door, and what machinery have they brought with them? But she's heard him and opens with a dimpled, chiding smile for being so wet. Tyrone, I missed you. He shrugs, convulsive, helpless, showering both of them. It's the only place I knew to come. Her smile slowly unpurses. Gingerly he steps across the sill, then, not sure if it's door or high window, into her deep room. Good mornings of good old lust. Early shutters open to the sea. Winds coming in with the heavy brushing of palm leaves, the wheezing break to surface and sun of porpoises out in the harbor. Oh, Katya groans somewhere under a pile of their batistes and brocade. Slothrop, you pig!
Oink, 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 says Slothrop cheerfully.
Sea glare dances up on the ceiling, smoke curls from black market cigarettes. Given the precisions of light these mornings, there are forms of grace to be found in the rising of the smoke, meander, furl, delicate fade to clarity. At certain hours, the harbor blue will be reflected up on the whitewashed sea facade, and the tall windows will be shuttered again. Wave images will flicker there in a luminous net. By then, Slothrop will be up, in British uniform, gobbling down croissants and coffee, already busy at a refresher course in technical German, or trying to dope out the theory of arrow-stable trajectories, or tracing nearly with the end of his nose some German circuit schematic whose resistors look like coils and the coils like resistors. What bizarre shit, once he got hip to it. Why would they go and switch it around like that, trying to camouflage it or what? Recall your ancient German runes, suggests Sir Stephen Dotson Truck, who is from the Foreign Office PID and speaks 33 languages, including English, with a strong Oxonian blither to it. By what? Oh, lips compressing, some kind of brain nausea here. That coil symbol there happens to be very like the old Norse rune for S, Sol, which means sun. The old High German name for it is Sigil. Funny way to draw that sun, it seems to Slothrop. Indeed, the Goths much earlier had used a circle with a dot in the center. This broken line evidently dates from a time of discontinuities, tribal fragmenting perhaps, alienation, whatever is analogous in a social sense to the development of an independent ego by the very young child, you see. Well, no, Slothrop doesn't see, not exactly.
He hears this sort of thing from Dodson Truck nearly every time they get together. The man just materialized one day, out on the beach in a black suit, shoulders starred with dandruff from thinning carrot hair, coming into view against the white face of the casino, which trembled over him as he approached. Slothrop was reading a Plastic Man comic. Katya was dozing in the sun face up, but when his footpads reached her hearing, she turned on one elbow to wave hello. The peer flung himself to full length, attitude 8.11, torpor, undergraduate. So this is a Lieutenant Slothrop. Four-color Plastic Man goes oozing out of a keyhole, around a corner, and up through piping that leads to a sink in the mad Nazi scientist's lab, out of whose faucet Plass's head now blank, carapaced eyes and unplastic jaws just emerging. Yeah, who are you, Ace? Sir Stephen introduces himself, freckles roused by the sun, eyeing the comic book curiously. I gather this isn't a study period. Is he cleared?
He's cleared.
Katya smiling, shrugging at Dodson Truck. Taking a break from that telefunken radio control, that Hawaii Eye. You know anything about that? Only enough to wonder where they got the name from.
The name?
There's a poetry to it, engineer's poetry. It suggests havari, average, you know. Certainly you have the two lobes, don't you, symmetrical about the rocket's intended azimuth. Howwind, too, smashing someone with a hoe or a club, off on a voyage of his own here, smiling at no one in particular, bringing in the popular wartime expression ab Howwind, quarterstaff technique, peasant humor, phallic comedy dating back to the ancient Greeks. Slothrop's first impulse is to get back to what that Plass is into, but something about the man, despite obvious membership in the plot, keeps him listening. An innocence, maybe a try at being friendly, in the only way he has available, sharing what engages and runs him, a love for the word. Well, it might be just Axis propaganda, something to do with that Pearl Harbor.
Sir Stephen considers this, seeming pleased. Did they choose him because of all those word-smitten Puritans dangling off of Slothrop's family tree? Were they trying to seduce his brain now, his reading eye, too? There are times when Slothrop actually can find a clutch mechanism between him and their iron-cased engine far away up a powertrain whose shape and design he has to guess at. A clutch he can disengage, feeling then all his inertia of motion, his real helplessness. It is not exactly unpleasant, either. Odd thing. He is almost sure that whatever they want, it won't be too much of his comfort. But he can't fit any of it into a pattern. There's no way to connect with somebody like Katya. Seductress and not so bad a game. There's very... Don't blame her. She's somewhere back in that London, and this is her job. She can be versatile, gay, and kind. And he'd rather be warm here with her than freezing back under the Blitz. But now and then, too insubstantial to get a fix on, there'll be in her face a look, something not in her control that depresses him. That he's even dreamed about and so found amplified there to honest fright. The terrible chance that she might have been conned, too. As much a victim as is. An unlucky and unaccountably futureless look. One gray afternoon, in where but the Himmler Spielsaal, where else, he surprises her alone by a roulette wheel. She's standing, head-bent, gracefully hip-shot, playing croupier. An employee of the house... peasant blouse and a rainbow-striped dirndl skirt of satin which shimmers underneath the skylight. The balls tattoo against the moving spokes, gather long, scratchy red in the muraled space. She doesn't turn till Slothrop is beside her. To her breathing, the grave, slow-beating tremor. He nudges at the shutters of his heart, open to him brief flashes of an autumn country he has only suspected, only feared, outside him, inside her. Hey, Katya. Making a long arm, hooking a finger on a spoke to stop the number they never see. Seeing the number is supposed to be the point, but in the game behind the game, it is night. She shakes her head. He understands that it's something back in Holland, before on him, and impermanently wired into the circuit of themselves. How many ears, smelling of Palmolive and Camay, has he crooned songs into? Outside the bowling alley songs, behind the Moxie billboard songs. Saturday night, open me another quart songs, all saying, honey, it don't matter where you've been, let's not live in the past, right now's all there is. fine for back there, but not in here. Tapping on her bare shoulder, peering in at her European darkness, bewildered with himself with his straight hair, barely combable, and shaven face without a wrinkle, such a chaste intrusion in the Himmlerspielsaal, all crowded with German Baroque perplexities of shape. A sacrament of hands in every last turn each hand must produce, because of what the hand was, had to become, to make it all come out exactly this way, all the cold, the trauma, the departing flesh that has ever touched it. In the twisted, guilt playing room, his secret motions clarify for him some. The odds they played here belonged to the past only. Their odds were never probabilities, but frequencies already observed. It's the past that makes demands here. It whispers and reaches after, and, sneering disagreeably, gooses its victims. When they chose numbers, red, black, odd, even, what did they mean by it? What wheel did they set in motion? Back in a room early in Slothrop's life, a room forbidden to him now, is something very bad. Something was done to him. And it may be that Katya knows what. Hasn't he, in her futureless look, found some link to his own past? Something that connects them closely as lovers? He's standing at the end of a passage in her life, without any next step to take. All her bets are in. She has only tedium now of being knocked from one room to the next. A sequence of numbered rooms whose numbers do not matter till inertia brings her last. That's all. Naive Slothrop never thought anybody's life could end like that. Nothing so bleak. But by now it's grown much less strange to him. He's been snuggling up, masturbatorily scared, elated, to the disagreeable chance that exactly such control might already have been put over him. The forbidden wing. Oh, the hand of a terrible croupier is that touch on the sleeves of his dreams. All in his life of what has looked free or random is discovered to have been under some control, all the time, the same as a fixed roulette wheel, where only destinations are important. Attention is to long-term statistics, not individuals. And with a house always does, of course, keep turning a profit.
You were in London,
she will presently whisper, turning back to her wheel and spinning it again, face averted, womanly twisting the night-streaked yarn of her past.
While they were coming down, I was in Schravenhache.
Fricatives sighing, the name spoken with exiles lingering.
While they were going up, between you and me is not only a rocket trajectory, but also a life. You will come to understand that between the two points, in the 5 minutes, it lives an entire life. You haven't even learned the data on our side of the flight profile, the visible or trackable. Beyond them, there's so much more, so much none of us know.
But it is a curve each of them feels, it is the parabola. They must have guessed once or twice, guessed and refused to believe, that everything, always, collectively, had been moving toward that purified shape latent in the sky, that shape of no surprise, no second chances, no return. Yet they do move forever under it. Reserved for its own black-and-white bad news, certainly as if it were the rainbow and they its children. As the war's front moves away from them, and the casino becomes more and more a rear area, as the water grows more polluted and the price rise, so the personnel coming down on leave get noisier and more dedicated to pure assholery. None of Tantivy's style about them, his habit of soft-shoe dancing when drunk, his make-believe foppishness and shy, decent impulses to conspire, however marginally, whenever possible, against power and indifference. There hasn't been a word about him. Slothrop misses him, not just as an ally, but as a presence, a kindness. He continues to believe here on his French leave, and at his ease, that the interference is temporary and paper, a matter of messages rooted in orders cut. An annoyance that will end when the war ends. So well have they busted the sod prairies of his brain, tilled and sown there, and subsidized him not to grow anything of his own. No letters from London. Not even news of Achtung. All gone. Teddy Bloat one day just vanished. Other conspirators, like a chorus line, will show up off and on behind Katya and Sir Stephen, dancing in, all with identical corporate smiles. The multiplication of whose glittering choppers is to dazzle him, they think, distract him from what they're taking away, his ID, his service dossier, his past. Well, fuck. You know, he lets it happen. He's more interested and sometimes a little anxious about what they seem to be adding on. At some point, apparently on a whim, though how can a fellow be sure, Slothrop decides to raise a mustache. Last mustache he had was at age 30 at Johnson Smith for a whole mustache kit. 20 different shapes, from Fu Manchu to Groucho Marx. They were made of black cardboard with hooks that fit into your nose. After a while, snot would soak into these hooks, and they'd grow limp, and the mustache would fall off. What kind? Katya wants to know, soon as this one is visible. Bad guy, says Slothrop. Meaning, he explains, trimmed, narrow, and villainous. No, that'll give you a negative attitude. Why not raise a good guy mustache instead? But good guys don't have. Oh, no, what about Wyatt Earp? To which might have advanced the objection that Wyatt wasn't all that good. But this is still back in the Stuart Lake era here, before the revisionists moved in. And Slothrop believes in that Wyatt, all right. One day a General Wyvern of Shafe Technical Staff comes in and sees it. The ends droop down, he observes. So did that Wyatt's, explains Slothrop. So did John Wilkes Booth's, replied Earl. Eh? Slothrop ponders. He was a bad guy. Precisely. Why don't you twist the ends up? English style. Well, I tried that. It must be the weather or something. The old duster just keeps drooping down again. And I need to bite those ends off. It's really annoying. It's disgusting, says Wyvern. Next time I come round, I shall bring you some wax for it. They make it with a bitter taste to discourage end chewers, you know. So as the mustache waxes, Slothrop waxes the mustache. Every day there's something new like this. Katya's always there, slipped by them into his bed like nickels under the pillow for his deciduous Americanism. Innocent incisors and mom-worshipping molars just left in a clattering trail back down these days at the casino. For some odd reason, he finds himself with hard-ons after study sessions. That's peculiar. There is nothing specially erotic about reading manuals hastily translated from the German, brokenly mimeographed, even a few salvaged by the Polish underground, the latrines at the training Sibliżna, staying genuine SS shit and piss, or memorizing conversion factors, inches, centimeters, horsepower to Pferdestärke, drawing from memory schematics and isometric snarled maze of fuel, oxidizer, steam, peroxide, and permanganate lines, valves, vents, chambers. What's sexy about that? Still, he emerges from each lesson with great hard-on, tremendous pressure inside, some of that temporary insanity, he reckons, and goes looking for Katya, hands to crab-walk his back and silk stockings squealing against his hip bones. During the lessons, he will often look over and catch Sir Stephen Dotson Truck consulting a stopwatch and taking notes. Jeepers. He wonders what that's all about. Never occurs to him it might have to do with these mysterious erections. The man's personality was chosen, designed, to sidetrack suspicions before they have a chance to gather speed. Winter sunlight, hitting half his face like a migraine, trouser wet and sandy because he's up every morning at 6 to walk along the Strand, Sir Stephen makes perfectly accessible his disguise, if not his function, in the conspiracy. For all Slothrop knows, he's an agronomist, a brain surgeon, a concert oboist. In that London, you saw all levels of command seething with these multidimensional geniuses, but as with Katya, there hangs about Dotson Truck's well-informed zeal an unmistakable aura of the employee and loser. One day, Slothrop gets a chance to check this out. Seems Dotson Truck is a chess star. One afternoon, he gets around to asking Slothrop if he plays. Nope, lying. Not even checkers. Damn. I've hardly had time till now for a good game. I do know a game. Has something of Cantivi been sheltering inside all this time? King game. It's called Prince. Maybe the English even invented it, 'cause you have those princes, right? And we don't. Not that that's wrong, understand, but everybody takes a number, and you start off the Prince of Wales has lost tails, no offense now. The number's going clockwise around the table, and number two has found them, clockwise from that prince, or whatever number he wants to call out, actually. He, that's the prince, six or anything, see? You pick a prince first, he starts it, then that number two, or whoever that prince called, says, but first he goes, the prince does, Wales, tails, two, sir, after saying that about how that Prince of Wales has lost his tails, and number two enters, not I, sir. Yes, yes, but, giving Slothrop a most odd look, I mean, I'm not quite sure I really see, you know, the point to it all. How does one win? Ah, how does one win indeed? One doesn't win, easing into it, thinking of Tantivy, one small impromptu counter-conspiracy here. One loses, one by one. Whoever's left is the winner. It sounds rather negative. Garçon? Drinks here are always on the house for Slothrop. They are springing for it, he imagines. Some of that champagne. Want you to just keep it coming, and any time we run out, go get more. Comprende? Any number of slack-jawed subalterns, hearing the magic word, drift over and take seats while Slothrop explains the rules. I'm not sure, Dotson Chuck begins. Baloney, come on, do you good to get out of that chess rut? Right, right, agree the other. Dotson Chuck stays in his seat a bit tense. Bigger glasses, Slothrop hollers at the waiter. How about those beer mugs over there? Yeah, they'd be just fine. The waiter unblasts the Jeroboam of Veuve Clicquot Brut and fills everybody up. Well, the Prince of Wales, Slothrop commences, has lost his tails, and number three has found them. Wales, tails, three, sir. Not I, sir, replies Dotson Truck, kind of defensive about it. Who, sir? Five, sir. Say what? Inquires Five, a Highlander in parade true, with a sly look. You fucked up, commands princely Slothrop. So you have to drink up. All the way now. No stopping to breathe or anything. On it goes. Slothrop loses Prince's position to four, and all the numbers change. The Scot is first to drop, making mistakes at first deliberate but soon inevitable. Jeroboams come and go, fat, green, tattered gray foil at the necks giving back the bar's electric radiance. Corks grow straighter, less mushroomy. Dates of dégorgement move further into the war years as the company gets drunker. The Scot has rolled chuckling from his chair, remaining ambulatory for some 10 feet where he goes to sleep against a potted palm. At once another junior officer slides, beaming into his place. The word has osmosed out into the casino, and there is presently a throng of kibitzers gathered around the table waiting for casualties. Ice is being hauled in by a giant block, fern-faulted inside, breathing white off of its faces, to be sledged and chipped into a great wet tub for the procession of bottles being run up from the cellar now in relays. It soon becomes necessary for the harassed waiters to stack empty tankards in pyramids and pour fountain style from the top, the bubble-shot cascades provoking cheers from the crowd. Some joker is sure to reach in and grab one of the mugs on the bottom, sending the whole arrangement swaying, everybody else jumping to salvage what they can before it all comes down, crashing, soaking uniforms and ooze so that it can be set up all over again. The game has switched to rotating prints, where each number called out immediately becomes prints and all the numbers shift accordingly. By this time, it is impossible to tell who's making mistakes and who isn't. Arguments arise. Half the room are singing a vulgar song. Vulgar song. Last night I poked the Queen of Transylvania. Tonight I'll poke the Queen of Burgundy. I'm bordering on the state of schizophrenia, but Queenie is so very nice to me. It's pink champagne and caviar for breakfast, a spot of Chateaubriand with me tea. 10 shilling panatellas now are all that I can smoke. I laugh so much you'd think the world was just a silly joke. But make way for the bloke that's poked the lovely little Queen of Transylvania. Slothrop's head is a balloon, which rises not vertically but horizontally, constantly across the room, whilst staying in one place. Each brain cell has become a bubble. He's been transmuted to black epa grapes, cool shadows, cuvées. He looks across at Sir Stephen Dotson Truck, who is still miraculously upright with a glaze about the eyes. Right, supposed to be counter-conspiring here. Yes, yes, now. He gets involved watching another pyramidal fountain, this time of sweet Tattinger, with no date on the label. Beauty dealers sit like birds along the bar, staring. Noise in the place, incredible. A Welshman with accordion stands on a table playing Lady of Spain in C, just zooming up and down that wheeze box like a maniac. Smoke hangs thick and swirling. Pipes glow in the murk. At least 3 fist fights are in progress. The Prince game is difficult to locate anymore. Girls crowd at the door, giggling and pointing. The light in the room has gone bare brown with swarming uniforms. Slothrop, clutching his tankard, struggles to his feet, spins around once, falls with a crash into a floating crown and anchor game. Grace, he warns himself. Grace. Roisterers pick him up by the armpits and back pockets and fling him in the direction of Sir Stephen Dotson truck. He makes his way on under a table, a lieutenant or two falling over en route, through the odd pond of spilled bubbly, the odd slew of vomit, till he finds what he imagines to be Dotson truck's sand-filled cuffs. Hey! Getting himself threaded among the legs of a chair, angling up to locate Dotson truck's face, haloed by a hanging, fringe-shaded lamp. Can you walk? Carefully swinging his eyes down on Slothrop.
Not sure, actually, that I can stand.
They spend some time at the business of untangling Slothrop from the chair, then standing up, which is not without its complications, locating the door, aiming for it. Staggering, propping each other up, they push through a bottle-wielding, wall-eyed, unbuttoned, roaring, white-faced and stomach-clutching mob, in among the lithe and perfumed audience of girls at the exit, all sweetly high, a decompression lock for the outside. Holy shit! This is the kind of sunset you hardly see anymore, a 19th-century wilderness sunset, a few of which got set down, approximated on canvas. Landscapes of the American West by artists nobody ever heard of, when the land was still free and the eye innocent, and the presence of the Creator much more direct. Here it thunders now over the Mediterranean, high and lonely, this anachronism in primal red, in yellow purer than can be found anywhere today, a purity begging to be polluted. Of course, Empire took its way westward. What other way was there but into those virgin sunsets to penetrate and to foul? End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.